Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, April 28th, 2025. It is, in fact, Election Day here in Canada. We'll be talking a bit about that during this show here. But we also got a lot of other good stuff for you. Election-related information. We have a report on the pros and cons of strategic voting. We also have a report on the lack of Indigenous issues as they've been somewhat lacking in this campaign, and the Indigenous community is feeling that. we have Gardening with Embark, our regular segment, and joining me in the studio here today is Stephen Fan, who's also got some arts reports.
I've actually got three little ones, but that will be later in the show, and yeah. It's going to be a pretty fact show.
Cool. And yeah, so that's our show for today. First, I'd like to talk a bit about the incidents in Vancouver this weekend on Saturday night. The tragedy at the Lapu Lapu Festival in South Vancouver, in which a vehicle right at the end of the festival, as people were packing up, but lots of people were still there, drove at high speed through the crowd, and 11 people were killed, dozens injured. According to the authorities, there's very good chance. Many people really badly injured. One witness reported people flying high up into the air as they were struck by the vehicle. 11 people have been killed. As I said, many, many more injured. There's a real fear that many more people who are currently in hospital may yet pass away, and that that number of dead could grow. Our hearts all go out to the Philippine community here in Vancouver who are most affected. The Lapu Lapu Festival was a Filipino community festival with people from around the community and vendors and performers and many, many others and families. And the whole community has been deeply, deeply affected. But the whole of Vancouver community has also been very deeply affected. This is not the kind of thing we expect to happen in Vancouver. You know, we kind of expect this kind of thing to happen in other places where world news happens, not here in Vancouver. And it's a real shock to see and to realize that this can happen here. I guess it's fortunate that, you know, authorities have ruled out the idea that it was terrorism related. The suspect was apprehended by bystanders and event security on the night of the incident. After the car finally came to a stop, he got out and attempted to run away, but was chased down and caught and held by bystanders and security until police could arrive. It appears that the incident was mental health related. The individual who's now been charged with 8 counts of murder yesterday afternoon in court was well known to police for a number of mental health incidents. And I expect a lot more information will come with that. Obviously, no matter what the reason for the tragedy, it at least, you know, it doesn't appear to be the kind of incident that might bring fear that there will be follow-ups, you know, as something that might be terrorism-related might suggest. And, of course, the incident terrorism has been ruled out as connected to this incident, which is good. So let's talk about the election, because it is election day today. And it's been a very interesting race. Stephen, when we were at New Year's time, let's just put the pin there. Yeah. It looked like the conservatives, in fact, the general consensus, and everybody believed the conservatives were set to cruise to a pretty easy victory and a big majority.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I have a political interest. I'm not really involved as much in active politics anymore, but like I keep in touch with people in politics, and you know, so like one of my friends is Brian Breguet, who is a fairly controversial BC conservative candidate from last year.
Yeah.
But like, you know, he's very personable, and so I was talking to him about this, and one thing that was always hanging over the 20-point Tory elite that was there for most of 2024 was structurally it doesn't make any sense. And what I mean by that is structurally, if you look at the trends from, let's say, the 2024 U.S. presidential election, there's been a lot of stuff happening. One of these things happening is what we call racial depolarization, which is that actually different people of different ethnicities have become voting in a more similar way to each other. So there's less difference between different ethnicities anymore. And that actually, at this stage, actually does benefit the liberals.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, and, you know, it was also based on the personal unpopularity of Justin Trudeau, and, you know, well, Justin Trudeau left.
Yeah, and the big part of, you know, the reason for the enormous, at the time, Conservative Party lead was Justin Trudeau's unpopularity and the extent to which the Conservative Party, through kind of relentless campaigning around that topic, pretty much since the beginning of Justin Trudeau's premiership, had taken what was probably, you know, a regular unpopularity of a nearly 10-year prime minister and really sort of demonized him well beyond that.
Turbocharging it.
You know, with the people driving around with F. Trudeau flags and stickers on their vehicles and stuff like that. The other part of their campaign was, of course, their strong opposition to the carbon tax. And, of course, what ended up happening is Justin Trudeau quit. The Liberal Party backed away from the carbon tax, and Mark Carney showed up on the scene, and then Trump.
Yeah, so Trump is kind of the big factor here. But I remember in the fall of last year, I was speaking with the Alberta conservative staffer, and he was like, look, you know, policy-wise, Pierre Poilievre was already a man out of his time, right? He would have been perfect for the election that was 4 years ago, mm-hmm. right? In the middle of COVID, you know, people felt frustrated. And now it's just not, you have so much world sort of like geoeconomic kind of uncertainty. Nobody, like, he doesn't quite carry the image of someone you would trust to manage the economy through a crisis. I think you're right about, you know, the way this, you know, there's a question of how much intrinsic unpopularity there was for Trudeau just because he was a prime minister for 9 years. Nobody becomes more popular after becoming, you know, prime minister after 10 years. I think there's also a sense, I think actually Trudeau himself is actually much shrewder than given credit for. You know, when he left, ever since he resigned being prime minister, and he's not running for parliament again, obviously, he's kept a very low profile. Mm-hmm. He's not been in the media. He's not done any interviews. He's absolutely stayed out of any kind
of... Well, he was very prominent through the leadership campaign, because of course he was still prime minister.
Yeah.
And of course he kind of had his swan song, where instead of having to slink away, you know, disliked and disrespected at the end after being forced out of office, which he was. I mean, it became apparent that he could not stay anymore. You know, he had this sort of swan song of dealing with, the first stages of the Trump presidency, and you know, his handling of that was recognized as being pretty good. I don't think that would have made a difference. If he'd stayed on, that would not have been enough to turn things around.
I think if he had stayed on, people would have gotten tired of it relatively quickly.
Yeah.
I don't think it would work. But I think one thing that's super interesting was when sort of Chrystia Freeland kind of did the thing end of last year, was like, you know, she dramatically resigned and, you know, challenged basically Trudeau for the leadership. I think Trudeau really had it in his mind at that point that he wanted Carney to succeed him.
Yeah.
And not necessarily just because he disliked Chrystia Freeland for what you know politicians would call backstabbing, but it's just, you know, what happens in politics. I think one thing is, I think he has come to the realization at the end of his prime ministership that a lot of the things that have gone wrong in his tenure are actually related to Freeland. And that, you know, because he was really driving the policy in the second half of his premiership. And it's, I think he has decided that it just kind of needed a different kind of prime minister. Yeah. And
although many people would argue that a lot of, you know, the policies that Freeland was pushing were, in fact, Trudeau's policies that she was, you know, obliged to follow, you know, follow her leader. And certainly the, you know, the final incident with where she, you know, resigned was that kind of
I don't even remember. It was something insanely stupid.
Well, it was about those, you know, they brought in that, the GST thing and
it's the rebates, isn't it?
The rebates and stuff like that. That didn't land that well. You know, I think apart from Friedland's actions, you know, the fact that those things didn't land well and kind of seemed like a desperate ploy to buy voters also didn't help Trudeau's case at the time. And then they wanted her to take the, you know, take the fall for it. Anyway, you know, there were definitely, you know, there's two sides to that. But anyway,
I don't mean to blame Freeland, actually. I think what I meant to say is that my personal observation of Trudeau, like, I've been close, like, I've kind of seen them up and close. Like, I've seen his former wife. Like, I've met with Freeland before. Is I don't think Justin Trudeau is a very good judge of character. and it's... I mean that in the nicest way possible. I think if you look at the people he's grown up with, he's known for a very long time. Generally, he's worked well with them. You know, Melanie Joly, like, a lot of people don't like her, but he's worked well with her. But if you look at the people he's recruited, like, 5 years before he entered politics, like 5 years ago, there's always been a falling out. There's been a falling out with you know, Christian Freeland. There's been a falling out with, you know, let's bring play the oldies, you know, Wilson Raybould. Like, it's not to relitigate who is at fault or who is not at fault. It's just these relationships never worked out.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get the idea that you know, as a leader, and this is a good part, you know, he really likes working with strong characters, strong people. But also as a leader, there's a point where he just wants to get his way, and that leads to a kind of clash with some of these folks who are all, you know,
I'm not sure he is strong enough personally to handle really strong leaders effectively, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing wrong with having strong leaders in your cabinet, but you need to be able to handle them respectfully, but also firmly. JWR, like Wilson Raybould, was such a bizarre case where initially he was entirely within his legal remit, and he started messing it up, and it just kind of evolved into a highly sort of legally shady situation.
Yeah.
And it was, the whole thing was just bizarre. Like, it was, and it's very reminiscent of the way Freeland's handled. Like, you know, you can't tell your finance minister to put out a budget saying something that she disagrees with 2 days before you're going to fire her. Like, just, you just can't do that.
And then expect her to take the fall for any bad news that comes for it.
And it's just, I just don't think he has a good instinct for dealing with really highly professional people, that he highly accomplished professional people he's met in his political life, as opposed to, like, people he's known through his brother, he's known through his family, where he just has a much closer sense of how things are going to go.
So all that happened.
Yeah.
Trump came along.
Yeah.
Then Carney came along.
Absolutely.
So
Carney is someone I've been kind of keeping an eye on for a very long time. I actually met with Carney in January.
Yeah.
He did like a very small meet and greet. It was like 20, 30 people.
This probably would have been before he formally announced his campaign?
This was like right after he announced, like a week after he announced.
Yeah.
And for leadership of the Liberal Party. But I, you know, me and a few friends of mine have been keeping a close eye on Carney for a very long time because it's been obvious that he wants to be prime minister. He wants to be prime minister.
Yeah.
And I think, obviously, he is prime minister for the time being anyways. But, like, my impression of meeting with him is that he reminds me of a senior consultant. Like he just reminds me of like a senior like McKinsey, PwC right. kind of a consultant. Very corporate, very professional, probably very effective.
One of the terms I think could apply to him, but hasn't really been used, is sort of the idea of a technocrat, someone who has been working at high levels in government.
Yeah.
In pretty responsible positions, but not as a political figure.
Yeah.
And as governor of the Bank of Canada, and then following that, governor of the Bank of England. You know, it's a very influential position. Working at the highest level in international affairs and national affairs, but not expressly a political position. So, and then he's coming in with this experience, which of course I think has been one of the things that's been working in his favor, this sort of, you know, who's able to present himself as someone who could manage the economy effectively, et cetera, and so forth.
So I absolutely agree. I think he is, in fact, the technocrat par excellence. And if you look at the posts he's held, the governor of the Bank of England, the governor of the Bank of Canada, these are two of the biggest technocratic jobs you can have anywhere in the world. And so he's had them. And so I don't think that's necessarily a good thing or bad thing in terms of his political experience. It's just a thing. But he doesn't strike me as having a very natural retail politician's touch, at least kind of in my interactions mm-hmm. with him, brief interactions with him. And I think perhaps one thing that's interesting about this is that this is perhaps something that could have only taken place in a country like Canada, where we don't really like politicians to pander to our prejudices that much,
right.
Because we expect kind of a hands-off kind of administrative competence from politicians to deliver services. But it's not like, you know, we don't want, you know, like the equivalent of Trump packing football stadiums full of rallies. Like, it's just not that's yeah. interesting to us. And I think if you have it, you know, like the idea of a technocratic prime minister, typically the comparison is made with Draghi, with Mario Draghi of Italy.
In Italy, yeah.
Who was the chief of the European Central Bank before.
And became prime minister in Italy during the big economic crisis.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a perfect comparison because Draghi was never elected. Draghi was appointed in what's a European system thing, what's called a technocrat, caretaker prime minister,
yeah.
in order to get, you know, Italy over the hump. And they subsequently elected a populist named Meloni. Yeah. Actually, a really good comparison, but that's a little while ago. This guy called Manmohan Singh, I can't pronounce his name correctly, yeah. In India. And he yeah. was prime minister of India for some time in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And before that, he was actually the governor, the head of the Reserve Bank of India.
Right.
So that's actually a great comparison because he won elections, assuming if Carney wins elections.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. But Singh was such a great comparison in another respect as well, is that he was also not a natural retail politician.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not like gregarious, and he's like very much a technocrat. Like, he was the head of the Central Bank of India. But India was facing some serious economic problems, very similar to the problems that Canada is having nowadays at a different level, productivity problems, basically.
Yeah.
The economy was just not being very productive. And Singh was basically brought in as kind of the technocrat in democratic guise to guide the country's economy, and India's economy has subsequently done really well. And he was successful, and he was, I think, elected. I don't know if he was re-elected, but he lasted quite some time.
Yeah.
And by general consensus, he's regarded as one of the most effective prime ministers of Indian recent history. And by the way, if you look at his last name, you realize how rare that is, because Singh is a Sikh last name.
Yeah.
And most prime ministers, and in fact, I think all prime ministers in India, except for him, have not been Sikh.
Yeah.
Mostly
from the Hindu community.
So it's a very unique yeah. situation. I think that's actually really comparable to Carney if yeah. he were to be successful.
Yeah. So then we have Polyev, mm-hmm. and he initially was pretty flat-footed, I think, in response to both to Trudeau's resignation and, you know, Trump's challenges.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't really, I think he took way too long to really respond effectively to you know, Trump's 51st state references and the tariffs and stuff. He seemed like initially he just didn't want to, he didn't want to piss off his supporters who also support Trump. Is that what, you know, I think probably what it was. I think that really hurt him.
Yeah.
And he also tried to, when it became obvious that Carney was going to be the new leader of the party, he initially really tried to sort of employ the same sort of slander tactics, and carbon tax Carney and other stuff like that, none of which really landed. And that seemed to hurt him. He's really shifted over the last 2 or 3 weeks to a bit of a different strategy, the Canada First messaging. And that seems to have worked better.
Actually, that's being retired in favor of bring it home, which is bizarre because that's a, like, I follow England football. Bring it home is like a very England football kind of thing because it's about bringing football home to England where it was invented. Association football, that's to say soccer. If you miss that context, bring it home doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So, like, I've never understood, like, when, like, Andrew Scheer is, like, enthusiastically shouting, bring it home. And it's like, bring what home? Bring what where? Like, it's, like, there needs to be enough context. And these are not people who, like, at least strikes me as being they follow English football that much. So I was just very confused. But on your point about Pierre Poilievre's shifts in messaging, I think the big point here to understand is that he's always been, you know, the great expression about this English politician, Boris Johnson, was that he was like the guy who wanted to have the cake and also eat it. Yeah. And I think that's the problem with Poilievre as well. You know, that he really desperately wants to have the cake and eat it, but he's just not very good at it. You know, it's like that. Yeah, you mentioned the way like he didn't want to split his base. You know, I think something like a quarter or like 40% of his base are like, you know, Trump, pro Trump or Trump curious. But I mean, like, we respect that. Like, it's fine. People can have their own opinions. He doesn't want to split that, causing internal party civil war. I get that part. But also at the same time, Doug Ford threaded at NATO, like literally a month ago, pretty successfully, and he was pretty full-throated in denouncing the tariffs.
I do think that's sort of one of the bits that made Poilievre look bad is that a fellow conservative like Ford stepped right in and was very bold in his messaging, and by contrast, Poilievre looked weak on that issue, right? Not just against whoever was in front of the Liberals, whether it was Trudeau at the time or later Carney, but even, you know, compared to other conservatives. And then, of course, we had Daniel Smith in Alberta saying all sorts of weird stuff that was not helpful at all.
I mean, one thing to remember is that Doug Ford has had other jobs other than politics, even if those were less than salubrious jobs. but, you know, like, I just had to fit in that dig because that was just absurd. Like, you know, Pierre Poilievre's literally never had a real job outside of politics. Look, here's my take on Pierre Poilievre. Like, the deal is that he tries to have it too good. My most memorable realization here, the moment I realized this has nothing to do with the Trump tariffs. The moment I realized this when he was talking about crime and immigration messaging. You know, like, conservative messages on crime is always tough on crime. Yeah. You know, like, but he was, on immigration was kind of like less immigration, whatever. But, like, he was trying to thread it so hard. Yeah, he was talking about how, like, temporary migrants who commit crimes in Canada will be sent back. And, like, I know that area of policy really well because, like, you know, like, it's for obscure reasons. I'm not related to it, but, like, I follow that area of policy. And suddenly it just strikes me as he's literally making a tautology because there is no such thing that would allow, like, Canadian law already does not allow temporary migrants who commit crimes to stay in Canada. It's just like, it's already established in law, like, 1,000, and there's like 1,000 different ways the law, you know, circumscribes this. And he was like, they're making like this like insane, like, he was trumping this up to be his big piece of policy in both crime and immigration, and he was stating something that was already true. It's not only already true, but it was true like 10 different ways. And And it was just like he was trying to be way too sneaky about this, right? If you're going to say that we want to punish people for committing crimes, say that. If you want to say you want less immigration, say that. Stop saying this whole thing where people who are on certain kind of visas who are commit... This is like reminds me of when like Kamala Harris was originally running for president in like 2016 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And one of her policy proposals is like, oh, you know, like we do like student debt, you know, like reductions for people who start, you know, Pell Grant recipients who start a business in minority, like a minority-owned business in like disadvantaged neighborhoods for at least three, like something insane, like, you know, just insane policy contortions.
Yep.
And it was, I was just not impressed.
All right, let's talk about Jagmeet Singh then. Jagmeet Singh.
I love his district, and he's going to lose his seat, by the way.
He's been squeezed by this whole issue. You know, we're going to talk, we have a report on strategic voting, and the idea of strategic voting, it's forefront in every Canadian campaign, but especially so this one, because there has been a lot of feeling that the people who don't want Polyev really do not want Polyev, and they're willing to change, you know, structure their voting to make sure that doesn't happen. And that seems to have entirely squeezed the NDP and Jagmeet Singh.
I will come out with a hot take against this, okay. Actually. And I know this has been the conventional wisdom, but I really don't think... Oh, let me put it this way. There's some strategic voting. Like, in a situation like this, with Trump tariffs, you know, people who don't like Polyev, who don't like Trump... are going to do some strategic voting. But I do not think strategic voting explains the majority of the NDP's vote collapse as reflected in the polls so far. And the reason I think that is that I think people fundamentally misunderstand NDP psychology.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example of how people misunderstand NDP psychology. I remember during COVID, and there was kind of the trucker convoy things.
Yeah.
I used to pop down, you know, to like the local pub. You know, it was like in the basement. It was a dive bar. And, you know, you go once in a while, you know, whatever. But the thing that's interesting about the bar was that it was all like NDP guys. It was all like NDP guys in union hats.
Yeah.
Right? And you go down during the convoy thing. It was last for 2 or 3 weeks. And you would expect these guys to be at least a little bit sympathetic. And I remember polling every single guy in the bar. The verdict was unanimous. They thought Trudeau was being too soft and he should call in the army.
Right.
So, like, I think people fundamentally misunderstand what NDPism is in a sense that they don't understand their voters. NDP has two kinds of voters. The kind of voters who are, like NDP union guys in the smaller towns and industrial places like Algoma, and also kind of urban professionals and, you know, people who are in care professions, government professions, whatever. And the thing about NDP voters shifting to Carney, I think, is that there is a long-term shift here in a sense of a lot of what's frustrating for people who voted NDP to try and pull Trudeau left during the Trudeau years was that the sense of that Trudeau was so not in control of the situation that they might as well just vote for the most left possible party to try and get the most, what they consider the most progressive outcomes. But one thing Carney has been able to do, I think in my view so far, is being able to reassure voters that he wants to deliver progressive outcomes, relatively moderately progressive outcomes, but in a way that's sustainable and competent. So it's not really clear to me that there's actually in Canada a constituency of like 20-30% of the population who are actually like literally on policy left of the Liberal Party. I think there are people who want progressive outcomes who are disappointed with Trudeau or who want the things to work a certain way. But are there, like, just like think about the intuitive question here. Like, are there 30% of Canadian voters who are literally left of the Liberal Party on most policies? I do not think so.
And, of course, the other part of that is the Liberal Party itself, depending on the zeitgeist, can move left or right to try and pick up those. You know, as a party of the center, they can move to the right or they can move to the left to try and...
I mean, I'm not sure if the party of the center is a party of power. But like...
I think those two things are related. And that flexibility, you know, has always worked well for them.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's take a quick look at polls because it is election day today.
Yeah.
And the way it stands now, the Liberals in national polling are at about 42-43%. The conservatives are at 39%, which on that level is really, really
exceptional.
Close. Closer than, you know, and it might seem like the whole race is a real horse race, but when you
break it down to regionals, it's a different story.
Yeah, regional. I'm just looking at, you know, the CBC has a thing where they combine a whole bunch of different polls, and you know, they are, you can see that their sort of range of expectation shows the Liberals looking a lot stronger than the Conservatives. And I think Abacus has the Conservatives looking at about 55-56% chance of forming majority versus somewhere down.
I think you meant the Liberals.
Liberals, yeah. A 55-56% chance, something about that, of forming a majority versus the Conservatives down in the mid-40s.
I remember it was. I remember in December it was 0% chance of liberal majority. But so like it was like 60% chance of conservative majority,
yeah,
or like something like that. Crazy. Like, look, these things change. But like, yeah, like I think there are a couple of variabilities here. The one thing is that the conservatives actually have been making interesting gains, and that I've followed this. Kind of, I talked to posters, yeah, and stuff like that in ethnic communities in Richmond, Surrey, Brampton, Markham, and so forth.
Yep.
There's a poll that just came out that shows that conservatives are actually ahead in Richmond Center. So that's interesting. So there's interesting things that might be happening. Really, where it matters is the 905 belt in around Toronto, because that's where the seats are. So is it enough to make a difference? I don't know at this stage. But like, is it interesting long term structurally for them in terms of what they can do? Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I would say Ontario is looking terrible for them, except for if they can make some surprise gains in the 905, then that would be interesting. But yeah, like Pierre Poilievre is a very kind of like, I don't know, he's not a very Ontario dude. I don't know.
All right, we need to wrap this up because we got some other reports to get to. So it's important to get out to vote, and it's easy to find out how to do it. You should have got a voting card mailed to you by Elections Canada. That's your easiest tool,
yeah,
which will tell you where your polling station is, and you can bring that card with you and show it to them, and everything else is pretty easy. If you don't have that, you can go to the Elections Canada website, just Google it, or Google where do I vote, and there they have a page. You just put in your postal code, and it will tell you what your riding is and where your polling station is located. It's good to bring some ID with you, or proof of residency if you've moved, which is one of the reasons you might not have got that voting card. And if you're not registered, generally you get registered by clicking a box on when you file your taxes, but you can register at the polling station. Find out where you're supposed to be and head out and vote today. All right, we have, as we've mentioned, strategic voting is one of the big issues in today's elections, and we have a report here all about that from our friends in Nanaimo. Stephen's going to be back in about 10 minutes talking about some exciting arts things happening in the community.
This is a CHLY and CVOX news update. The election is in its final stretch on Vancouver Island, and with the right side of the Canadian political spectrum mostly consolidated within one party, many progressive voters are calling for strategic voting, a strategy to align votes with the most popular party on one side of the spectrum. In this case, the left. Political science professor Stuart Prest from the University of British Columbia explains instances where strategic voting may benefit voters in a first-past-the-post electoral system.
It works potentially when there is a close vote between two front-running parties and the voter in question has a clear preference between those two parties, even though there's a third party that they would, in a vacuum, prefer to see win.
He explains that in a hypothetical riding where Party A on the right and Party B on the left are neck and neck, And Party C, also on the left, is running a more distant third, then if a voter has a preference that the stronger left party win, they might vote for B, even if their usual choice would be C. In our case, Party A would be conservative, and parties B and C would be parties like the NDP, Liberals, or Greens.
And that's the kind of scenario where it makes sense to engage in a kind of strategic voting. But if it's hard to say which of those two more progressive parties is more likely to win, if they seem like they're pulling relatively closely within a given, and it's at the level they're riding, you have to think. Or if you're just not sure which has a better chance of winning, because it's often quite hard to get a really good signal at the level of a single riding who is more likely to be ahead. And it doesn't really make as much sense. You're really just trying to guess what other people are thinking, and you're probably better off just voting for the party that you'd really rather see win.
Active community member and past Comox Valley Regional Board Director Arzina Hamir shared her own experience having run in the recent provincial election as a Green candidate.
In my own campaign, I ran as a BC Green in 2024. We had, a split between myself and the NDP, and, splitting the voters did enable, a conservative MLA to be elected. So when it doesn't work, those are the consequences. You get a non-progressive being elected because the right is consolidated.
Hamir says that the 2024 provincial election had the unique opportunity for progressive voters to not fear splitting the vote between parties on the left, as there were also two parties running on the right, the BC Conservative and the BC United parties.
That was actually an opportunity for us to not have to vote strategically and to vote with your conscience. And that was so exciting until the United pulled out, right? And most of the votes then consolidated around one candidate on the right.
Hamir says she does not regret running and does not feel she should have pulled out of the race.
I ran a campaign absolutely thinking that I could be elected. And, just by the number of volunteers and the amount of donations and the door knocking that we did, I thought we had the metrics and everything to get me across that finish line. But what ended up happening, people did have that fear come in, and they supported, the older parties that they were more used to. But I ended up taking a few thousand votes away from the NDP versus the previous provincial election in 2020. And that was enough for the Conservative MLA to be elected. So yeah, it's a pretty good example of what can happen if you don't have a strategic, if you've got a right that's got just one candidate. And we had two when I began, so this was my hope. But when you just have one and then the left is split, that's what happens.
Hamir doesn't think that political parties and candidates should run or not run based on concerns of splitting the vote. However, in the case of the federal election happening right now, she feels that once polling is showing if it is clear that one party on the left is breaking the 30% mark, the others should make way for the stronger candidate.
Since nobody has pulled out and, the campaigns are where they are in 2025, it would be really nice for one of the candidates to signal to the other, polling is showing I'm weaker and I'm going to encourage my voters to vote for you. I think that would be such a hero move, and that candidate would be really regarded well in the community. And then moving forward, until we can reform the way that we vote in Canada, it's a tough call.
When speaking about electoral reform, Hamir made it clear that she feels we should have already moved to proportional representation by now.
It's really sad that the Liberal Party and, in Justin Trudeau's kind of parting words was like he wished he had gotten proportional representation done. Well, hello. Why did that not happen? It was a promise of the Liberal Party and they totally backed down from it. And I really don't understand, because I know the NDP wanted to support it. So the two parties themselves could have pushed that through. I think, especially when larger parties get a majority in government, they have zero incentive to reform the way that the system works. And that's unfortunately what's happened back and forth in our parliament. And it just really has done a number on vote. And you see like lower and lower voter turnout because people don't feel that their votes count.
Professor Stuart Prest shared a bit of humor on the subject.
The joke I sometimes tell is that proportional representation in Canada will eternally be the choice of the party that finishes third. And that if you are, or if you're finishing first and you are in control of government, you don't really have a strong incentive to change the rules. And if you finish second, then, well, you're just a hair's breadth away from holding power yourself until you want to try again the next time around. And it's only if you are in third place or after that you might say that, well, maybe the way we count votes is not the as fair as it could be.
Prest says that because of this, demand for change is unlikely to come from the, quote, political class or from the parties themselves, and would have to originate elsewhere, such as through citizens demanding institutional reform. In the meantime, under the current first-past-the-post system, Arzina Hamir feels that the issue of strategic voting in the North Island Powell River riding this election is not only a matter of importance as a progressive voter opposed to one party, but as a citizen concerned over the potential impacts of a certain candidate.
Strategic voting on the North Island is incredibly important to me because I'm seeing a candidate whose popularity is surging, who not only doesn't represent my views, but I think holds some very toxic values in relation to First Nations, to women, LGBTQ, to plus community. And I see that the majority of our community doesn't actually believe in those types of values. So I want to see our values actually represented through who we elect. And right now it doesn't in first past the post. And strategic voting is the only way right now that we can ensure that those values show up in who represents us in Ottawa. So that's why it's important to me.
The candidate she is referring to is Conservative Aaron Gunn, who has been a common topic in the media recently following calls from Indigenous leaders and community members for the Conservative Party to drop the candidate. This stems from past remarks Gunn has made online stating there was no genocide of Indigenous people in Canada and claiming residential schools were asked for by Indigenous bands. In 2021, Gunn was denied his application to run for leadership in the BC Liberal Party as a direct result of these comments. Prest added to this dialogue as well, acknowledging that similar to his previous explanation, if there is a candidate a voter would really like to see lose and that voter has a very good idea of who has the best chance to beat them, then it makes sense to vote for that candidate rather than voting with one's conscience.
So this may be that kind of scenario. For those who are really disturbed by some of Mr. Gunn's comments in the past and would really like to not see him elected to represent their district, to have serious not just partisan, but moral qualms about some of the things that he's stood up for in the past, then it comes down to a question of trying to figure out who would stand a best chance of defeating them. And absent signals from the other parties within the race, and this may be the kind of situation where even on a local level, candidates might find a way to coordinate themselves, to signal that one is willing to stand aside to ensure that Mr. Gunn is not elected. But absent that kind of signal, then it really falls to the voters themselves to figure out how to coordinate those votes in some other way.
Aaron Gunn was contacted for comment, but did not respond by the deadline. Arzina Hamir has some suggestions for where curious individuals, particularly on the left, can find more information for strategizing their vote, if so inclined.
If people are wanting to know, like, who is the more, progressive, like, who can represent, who should I put my strategic vote to, like, don't count on me, because obviously I'm partisan myself. There are a number of websites that are available in Canada. VoteWell.ca is one of them. I think Cooperate for Canada is another one. Do a search. There's a number online, and they're third party. So, I have zero connection to any of these sites. They're the ones that are putting forward the data. And so you could use that as a way to figure out who to vote for.
No matter who you intend to vote for, General Election Day is Monday, April 28th, and polls will be open for 12 hours. Find your polling station and hours on your voter information card or through Elections Canada's Voter Information Service at elections.ca. For new voters, there is no deadline to register, and it can be done at the polling station before casting your ballot. To vote, you must be a Canadian citizen, at least 18 years old on Election Day, and prove your identity and current address. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
All right, and thanks to Heather Watson at CJLY Nanaimo for that report. Tonight on CJSF, we are participating in a national alternative election broadcast running from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. Our own Jesse Wentzloff will be here in the studio contributing along with correspondents from across the country. So tune in for that tonight. If you have anything you'd like to say or chime in on anything we say here on Speak Up, you can send us a text to our studio line at 778-782-2573. All right, Stephen, you've got you've been getting around and getting artsy.
Yeah, I've been chatting to a few theater companies and so forth. I'm just going to do a quick few announcements. The first one is Real City Music Theater. That's in Westminster. They're putting on a show that's already started, actually, April 25th to May 11th at the Massey Theater in Westminster. That's for those of you who are newest old-timers. That's where the Westminster Secondary School is. The show is called it's the Dolly Parton show, actually. It's called in 9 to 5 the Musical. It's the show that was actually originally made by Dolly Parton. The book is by Patricia Resnick, and it was based on the 1980 hit movie, and it's just like a fun little musical. And there's not much to say. It's like, it's very empowering, you know. It's about, yeah, like, it's about three female co-workers who concoct a plan to get even with the sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot they call their boss. Enough said. Go out there and buy a ticket. Enjoy that show. That's number one. The second thing is Corleone. Corleone is a men's choir, what's called a low voice choir. It's a very classical thing, actually, but it's really fun. And they have like up to 70 members. It's like a super fun thing. And they're doing a big show. It's called the Big Roar, and it's just kind of like it's happening in May. It's happening on May 3rd at the Chan Center in UBC, 4 p.m. And it's about, it's kind of just one of their big programs at the beginning of summer. There's actually kind of 30 and 35 and under pricing, student pricing, I'm sure, available. And it's just like, for people who haven't seen this before, like just men's choirs, a cappella, really, kind of large scale, it's incredibly fun. And it's, we had something like this at university. It was just like awesome. So check out the tickets. Figure it out. It's going to be amazing. One more thing is that this show already happened, unfortunately. It's called Peeping Tom's. This is actually one of the most interesting ones. It's Peeping Tom's Diptych. And it's a dance show by a Belgian company. And I chatted with the director, producer, whatever, and it was presented in Dance House. It happened on April 24th to 26th. And it was kind of just incredibly Belgian interpretation of kind of the journey into the subconscious. And
as interpreted through dance?
As through creative dance, from interpretive dance.
You know, when you think of a dance, it's probably a really great way to express ideas about the subconscious. Anyway, I didn't want to pull you off track.
No, that's fine. It's fine. It's so cool because, like, you know, it's the Belgian dance, and it's like surrealist. It's amazing. Unfortunately, I wasn't here, but I'm sure it's going to come around sometime again later on in the year or whatever. I really recommend people finding out about these guys. It was at the Vancouver Playhouse.
What was the company called?
It was called Peeping Tom. It's a very memorable name, Peeping Tom. And this is a very typically Belgian, bizarre, kind of surrealist name. Go for it. So it's going to be, there's a lot of interesting art stuff happening in Vancouver as kind of summer gets going. I'm sure we're going to have tons more to talk about. But yeah, it's going to be great.
Great. In just a moment, we are going to bring you Gardening with Embark. Once again, I want to remind you that we are going to be live on the air tonight from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. as part of a national alternative election broadcast featuring correspondence and reports from our fellow stations, community radio stations all across the country. CJSF's Jesse Wentzloff will be here. And please tune in for that. If you want to check in on any of our CJSF's election coverage, you can find that on our SoundCloud page. Just look for SoundCloud CJSF FM, and you will find all our reports there. And, of course, get out and vote. We'll be back one more time before the end of the hour. But this next up is Gardening with Embark. And good morning. It is time for Gardening with Embark with our resident gardening expert, Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Glad you're here. We're into week 17.
Correct. 17 weeks.
That's like a third through the year already, the calendar year.
Yep.
But we're still at the beginning of gardening season.
Correct. We are at the beginning of the gardening season, and the weather has improved. The last 2 weeks, nice and sunny. And now it's really telling us, nature is telling us, don't forget to water.
Right.
So today we will be talking about watering.
Okay. And it's not as simple as just getting your bucket and spraying some water, or perhaps, you know, the hose and just...
No, it's more than that.
Yeah.
So watering, we usually see through the advertisements, people or gardeners just spraying over the plants, which is what advice to do.
Yeah.
So watering, we have a rule that is water the soil, not the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the soil absorbs the water, and the water is taken by the roots of the plants. And, 80 to 90% of a plant in weight is water.
Mm-hmm.
So, we need to provide as much water as needed, but no every day. We have to be careful, because sometimes we are too much in love with our plants. We care too much that we water almost every day.
Yeah.
At the end, we are wondering why my plant is not doing well. It's too much water.
Right.
So we water the soil, not the leaves, and we water now and then, and we water every day, not frequently.
Right. So how much do you need to pay attention to the weather and the temperature particularly?
Okay, so by watering the soil, it doesn't matter at what time of the day you water.
Mm-hmm.
It could be early in the morning, midday, or late in the evening. Is as long as you water the soil.
Right.
Yeah, so here is a few. We water, we meet with the students at noon.
Mm-hmm.
So we water at noon, but we water the soil. The weather, if it's very, very dry, we have a dry spell that we need to make sure that we water constantly around 3 to 4 days in between.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other is how much.
Right.
That is the other, how often is one, and the other is how much water I put in my garden bed. So here we have a 4x4 feet garden bed, and one day I decide to see how many gallons of water I use it. So each 2 square feet, so takes around 4 gallons of water. So it was quite a few trips, mm-hmm, in order to soak the soil nicely. Now, when we try to water the soil, we make sure that we are watering deep.
Yeah.
So the water really gets 1 feet, 1.5 feet deep. So that's how much water we need.
Right.
Because roots grow where there is water, or follow where the water is. So water, air, and nutrients is where we want the roots to grow.
Yeah.
So the deeper the water, the deeper the roots will grow. And if you forget 1 or 2 days to water, is no problem.
Mm-hmm.
The roots are so deep, and the soil is very moist down there. But if we just sprinkle over the soil, the roots will stay at the surface. And if you forget 1 or 2 days to water, your plants will suffer, because they are so shallow, the roots.
So when you're talking about that several gallons, what was it, 4 gallons?
Or 4 gallons, yeah.
Now, is that something you'd normally do, or were you sort of doing an experiment to see what it
was? Just an experiment.
Yeah.
Because so we have 4 gallons of water for two. So in total, it was around 12 gallons of water per garden bed.
Right, for a 4x4
yes.
box.
And then I have 16 garden beds.
Yeah.
So I'm no going to water by hand. I'm going to water using watering cans.
Yeah.
So that's why we have a hose.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so with a hose, we more or less take around 5 to 6 minutes to water one garden bed. So making sure that the water really seeps down, and we water twice a week, more or less.
So you can't be just popping out before you leave the house in the morning, give it a quick spray and go. That's not going
to
be enough.
No, it's not going to be enough. Yeah. Yeah. So it has to you have to slow down, water the soil, water around the plants completely, and observe that the water really seeps down, and yeah, and be confident that the water goes very well deep and the roots will take.
Excellent. Well, that's I think that might be a thing a lot of people perhaps aren't as aware of as they should be, just how much you need to water.
Yes, yes. You need to put a decent amount of water. The other thing that we need to consider is that we are doing urban agriculture, mm-hmm. and we depend from municipal water.
Right.
So we have to be conscious about as well, because at beginning of May,
yeah.
we start with the restrictions, water restriction.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very careful with that, not to waste water. So water early in the morning or late in the afternoon, and water as deep as possible, making sure that you don't water every day.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you have to consider that not all plants like water quite often. For instance, like carrots, mm-hmm. you only will water when it's a dry spell, so you don't need to water quite often.
Yeah.
The other plants that they don't like water on the leaves, such as the gourds, so mm-hmm. zucchinis, pumpkins, they don't like water on the leaves.
Right.
And they that tend to create this wild powdery mildew, which is this white powder on top of the leaves, and later we are wondering why my plant is sick. Well, we've been just spraying water, so that we need to slow down and make sure that the water is dispensed to the root. Here we use a watering wand with a shower head,
right?
And this is the only setting that we have.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we gardeners tend to get gadgets, mm-hmm. and one of those gadgets is a nozzle, a watering nozzle. With 9 to 12 settings, even and then we when we are watering, it's like I only use one, the shower head. When I'm lazy, I may use the second. This is the jet set, because I don't want to walk to the other end of the
you
garden.
Right, you can stand back and just
yeah.
But of course, if you're doing that, you're getting it all over the leaves.
All over the leaves, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there is like mist. Well, mist. Well, the plant doesn't benefit from mist. No.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So that's all the things that. So a watering wand with a shower head, and we put the shower head close to the soil, around 1 inch above the soil.
Right. Okay.
So making sure that the soil doesn't splash. This soil, the water goes there straight to the soil, and all around the plant.
Right. And you're getting down there, and do you have an extender so you don't have to bend over?
Well, yeah, they could be 2 feet long, watering one. So, yeah, you don't have to bend. And, yeah, so that as well prevents us to spray everything and forces us to slow down in order to water. So, as I say here, we water 5 to 6 minutes. So, yeah, watering can take quite a long time, depending on the garden beds that you have.
Great. All right. Anything we've missed before we go?
Anything? Most of the depth of the roots, so most of the plants put around 2 feet deep of roots, except and then we have plants like potato, corn, beans, they're really 3 feet deep roots. So, yeah. So if you have a growing beans and tomatoes in containers, 5-gallon containers, you make sure that the bottom of the container is wet, is moist.
Yeah, you really need to get that water on there to
make sure that
get the soil wet all the way down.
Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. So what are our key tips about watering to finish up?
Oh, the key tips are water the soil, not the leaves, water it frequently, and try to water either in the morning or in the evening, and there are some. Get to know your plants that you're watering, because we don't want to create an environment that is high humidity and high temperature, which invites diseases like bacteria and fungal diseases to grow in your plants. So try to keep the leaves quite dry.
Well, thanks so much, Pablo. That's really great advice, especially as we start heading into the warmer days.
Yep.
Thanks thanks for joining us this morning.
It was a pleasure. And we will see you outside in the garden.
Excellent. Tell us very quickly how to find out more about Embark Sustainability.
Yeah, Embark Sustainability is based on a student union building in the ground floor. And you can follow our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week.
We'll be back next week.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Speak Up. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Thanks to Stephen Fan for joining me for our sort of review of the election season so far. It is voting day. Get out and vote. If you want to comment on anything you hear on, here in CJSF, give us a text, 778-782-2573. Democracy Now! Is coming up right now. Stay tuned.